So, my name is Marc Stamminger. I'm going to give this lecture here, Computer Graphics, in this term, and I would like to start with a few organizational things. Probably you know that we have exercises that run in parallel with this lecture, and we will speak about how all this is handled, and the different types of modules, for instance. You know that this lecture here is 3 hours a week, which corresponds to 3.75 ECTS or credit points. And you can combine this lecture with exercises. And we have two models for this. The first one is basic exercises. That's rather simple exercises with an effort that should be about 2 to 3 hours a week, which gives you another 1.25 ECTS. So if you combine these to a module, we will end up with 5 ECTS. And we have additionally advanced exercises. These are more complicated exercises that will take you about 5 to 6 hours a week. And this gives you another 2.5 ECTS. So we have these two types of modules. This one, it's difficult to read here. This is called CGVU, this module. Yeah, this is 5 ECTS, and the larger one is 7.5. So for the 7.5, you need to do the basic exercises and the advanced exercises. I will come back to that in a minute. To pass the exercises, you have to hand in assignments every week. And you need 50% of the points in these basic exercises and 50% of the points in the advanced exercises to pass the exercises. The exercises is only pass-fail. Yeah, you just have to pass them. That doesn't mean that you should stop with the exercises as soon as you have 50%, but several of you will do so anyhow. Yeah, but that's not the concept behind that. Yeah, and I hope you realize that the exercises help to understand the content of the lecture, yeah? But on the other hand, I perfectly understand that they require work and so on, yeah? But I mean, okay, that's how it is handled. The grade in the end comes from a written exam. So we will have a written exam probably in March, April next year. And the grade then only comes from this written exam. But to pass the entire module, you also need the exercises. Okay? Good. So, for the material, for the lecture, we have a course on Stud.on. This course is already available. We publish the lecture slides here on the in this Stud.on course. So also this this slides which we are looking right now, you can already download, and the first slide set I will show today. Then from time to time we publish additional material on Stud.on. We will publish the exercises, and we have a forum. So if you have any question in particular about the exercises, please ask there. Our tutors will read that forum regularly and you will get answers there. And of course, we want you to ask these questions on the forum, is that we don't want to answer the same questions, yeah, again and again and again. So if you're the first one to have a question, yeah, please ask that question on the forum. And if you have a question, look on the forum. Maybe others already asked that question before. So we can handle that more efficiently. Furthermore, the lecture will be recorded. Yeah, so you see the camera in the back. You see that I have a microphone. So you can also have a look at these lectures later on. Here you can see the URL, and there's also an email. Probably if you have questions about the video, or if you want to push them to publish the videos earlier. I don't know how long does it take usually to publish the video, 2 days or so? Okay, so within 2 days, we promise you that the video is always available. No, we don't promise. Good. For the exercises, we handle the exercises not with Studon, but with another system, which is called EST. I think most of you know EST from other lectures, so it just much better supports things like teams and to give feedback on the exercises and so on. This is why we use EST for that. And you can also hand in your solutions via EST. And since there are so many students in this lecture, we ask you to complete the exercises or to do the exercises in teams of two. Yeah? So EST can handle all that, that you can hand in your exercises in teams. And if you have special concerns about that or whatever, or we have an uneven number of students and you're the last one, yeah, who doesn't find a teammate, then please contact us, or you can also ask in the exercises and we can handle that. Yeah, but please, by default, hand in teams of two. And our tutors will then look at the solutions or at your hand in exercises. They will give you points and they will give feedback about your exercises. Okay, so for you that means you have to register via Studon. This is very simple. I assume everybody of you has a login or already logged into Studon. And if you do so, you will find that course, yeah, using that path, and you can immediately then register for the course. You won't need a password or anything. Yeah, just select enter the course, and you can see everything. For EST, yeah, you really have to log in with EST. So go to this link that you see here. And then you will find computer graphics and you can register under the normal way. Okay, good. So yeah, please register, do that early. There's no deadline until when you have to do that. You don't have to sign in for certain days to get a good day or something like that, but just register. It's also important because from time to time we make announcements via these lists. Yeah, so whatever lecture must be postponed or something like that. And then we need to know who is in this lecture. Yeah, and to this end, please just register so it's for free. And we won't spam you with stuff. It's really only important stuff. Okay. The lecture, as I said, is 3 hours per week, and this year we will organize it in this way that I will give this lecture 4 hours a week, so it will be Monday and Thursday, both 2 hours, so 90 minutes, yeah, 2 academic hours, and by this we will have finished the lecture just for Christmas, yeah, so we will finish the lecture Christmas. After Christmas, there will be no lectures anymore, except one or maybe two where we make a preparation for the exam. Yeah, of course, we will announce that early enough, probably in the last week of the lectures. You have the possibility, yeah, to attend that exam preparation where I show old exams and explain the solutions and maybe yeah, explain what you should take care of for the exam. Yeah? Okay, so here you see my plan for the schedule. I hope I can keep it. And yeah, we will be ready just before Christmas. Okay, the lecture, as I said, Mondays and Thursdays. Here you see the times. It will always be here in this room. For the exercises are not exercises in the sense that there is a tutor standing in front of you and explaining some stuff or whatever. The exercises means that these are time slots where tutors are available in the SIP pools to answer your questions. Yeah. So they know the exercises, they know how the solution should look like, and if you have any problems, ask them. Yeah? Here you see the images. You will quickly find out who they are by those who are surrounded by many people, probably. Yeah. So if you have any problems with the exercises, go there and they will explain you. Yeah, that's their task. That's what they are doing in this time. Okay, so please use this opportunity. Of course, outside these exercise times, you can always ask on the forum and get help from there or from your colleagues or similar. Yeah, but for these times, there will always tutors be available to ask them. Okay, if you have organizational questions, yeah, you can always ask Jana Marcinke. This is her email. Yeah, so she's organizing the exercises. So if you have any organizational questions, please ask her. If you have questions about the content, ask in the forum or ask the tutors. And as I said, the tutors will read the forum and will answer also, not within 5 minutes, but as soon as possible, they will answer your questions directly in the forum. Okay, good. So to attend the tutorials, you see the tutorials take place in the Hubertzip. Yeah, that's I think it's even the official name. And so the room number you find in Univis, if you don't know where it is, but you need special access to that Hubertzip if you don't have so. And to get access, ask the zip pool admins. Yeah, so they can grant you access for this particular zip pool. Yeah, so if you don't have access there, please contact the zip pool admins and they can give you access for that pool. Okay, any more things? Good. So the exercises, as I said, we have two sorts of exercises, basic and advanced exercises. And every week we will publish an exercise sheet. This exercise sheet essentially is an HTML file. I will show you in a minute. And this exercise sheet has two parts, the basic exercises and the advanced exercises. This sheet will always be published on Mondays at 1 p.m. or around noon. And from then on, you have, from then on, you have 10 days to work on this exercise sheet, on this assignment. And you have to hand in the sheet Thursdays, 1 p.m. Yeah, so that's the deadline. Until then, you can hand in your exercise via EST. So the sheets are always overlapping some days. Yeah, so when the new sheet gets out, you can already work on it, but there's still the deadline for the old one is still coming. So I hope that will work out nicely. And I think it's pretty clear the deadline is always given on the exercise sheet, so you will see that immediately. We will have 10 sheets, for the 10 weeks of the lecture. And for basic and advanced, you get 10 points per sheet. And in the end, you need 50% of the points. And again, to make the 7.5 ECTS module, you need to do the basic exercises and the advanced exercises, okay? Good. For the advanced exercises, we will at some point switch to C++. And I know many students love C++ and they're very keen on learning C++. And in fact, we do not, it's definitely not hardcore C++. Most of the code almost looks like Java. So it's not a very big deal in my eyes. Yeah, so blame me if I'm wrong. If you have any problems with C or C++, we provide here a tutorial under this link, that you can already do right now. Yeah, and it just explains the basics of C++ as far as you will need it for the exercises. This is definitely not a C++ course. Yeah. So we only use very basic functionality of C++, so that you have classes for vectors and for matrices and so on. But it's on a very basic level, very similar to Java. Okay, if you are experienced with C++, that's no problem anyhow, then you can simply skip that part. Otherwise, look at the tutorial. If you say, okay, that's easy, no problem, then you're fine. And if not, just look at it and make the simple exercises, and you will learn enough to do the exercises. Okay, let's maybe have a short look at how these sheets look like. Okay. So here you can see how these sheets look like. So first of all, yeah, we have again an explanatory part that explains again what I'm saying here, when to submit the exercises and so on, and how that entire thing works. For instance, the SIPMAP is a tool that we will use for if you want to ask questions to the tutors, and there are too many questions, yeah, so there is a queue, then this tool organizes that you can set a flag, yeah, and as soon as it's your turn, the tutor will come to you and so forth, yeah. So this is all described here on the exercise sheet in the beginning. Then we have the basic exercises and the advanced exercises. Yeah, here you see, I hope it's clearly enough marked, advanced exercises. The exercises are most, or if not all of them, are programming exercises. And to keep things simple, we decided to use JavaScript for these exercises. That's a very simple programming language. Again, for the purpose we use here, it's almost like Java, yeah? And the big advantage is that it runs directly in the browser. You don't have to install any develop environment or something like that. You can directly program or do the solutions within the browser, or you write program and immediately in the browser you see whether the result is correct. You will quickly see how that works. Essentially, you really program within the exercise sheet. So the exercise sheet, as you get, you see here, assignment A is draw a circle. On the right, yeah, you see a white box. Yeah, there's nothing drawn yet. So your task is now to write code that draws a circle into that window. And if you do that properly, yeah, your solution looks like this. Yeah, you directly see the solution next to your text, and then you see it's refined. There is also a dark border drawn around, and so forth. Yeah. So, I hope it's really. Yeah, and here the last one is missing for some reason. I don't know why. Yeah. So it worked out well in the last years. Yeah, to do it this way. And I hope you also won't have problems with that. Okay, and for the advanced exercises, yeah, we have something more colorful. Of course, even if you're always welcome to do these advanced exercises, even if you only want to have 5 ECTS. We have something more colorful here for generating these Mandelbrot images. And So this is how it looks like if you download the exercise sheet, and this is how it should look in the end. And you can move around here and zoom in and change the color schemes. Yeah, we will also speak about color today. So this is what we learn here. And yeah, it's nice in the end. And all, I hope, well described. Okay? This is the concept. You learn 2 programming languages, which is good. and an interesting experience, I hope. Okay, and the first exercise sheet is already available. Yeah, it's the one you saw here. And it's due next week. So next week, Thursday, you have to hand in your solutions. So there's enough time. You can go to the tutorials on Friday and on Monday if you have any problems with all that stuff. And on Thursday, you have to hand in. So there's enough time. But that does not mean wait until Thursday morning. But do it as early as possible so we won't run into problems. Okay, and this is again what you should do in the first, draw a circle as basic exercise and draw these nice Mandelbrot sets and Julia sets in the advanced exercises. Okay, are there further organizational questions or questions on the lecture? Yeah. For the basic exercises, we use JavaScript. Yeah, it's a... it's a language that is naively supported by all web browsers. Yeah, it's the language, if you write programs that run in a web browser, then this is implemented in JavaScript. And for our purpose, that's just fine, yeah, because you don't need to install anything. It really directly runs in any browser, Chrome, Firefox, whatever. And it's at the level we are using it, it's very, very similar to Java. Yeah, so it shouldn't be a complicated step to do it in this language. And the advanced exercises will be in C++. Not in the beginning, at some point we will switch to C++ in the advanced exercises. Okay, more questions? Yeah?
Are there still exercises after Christmas? Because there's no lecture anymore?
Yes. So the last exercise sheet, okay, so this is not by 100%, but I think the last exercise sheet, so the deadline will be after Christmas, but in general there will be no exercises after Christmas.
Okay.
Maybe also another thing I did mention, so obviously the lecture is in English. Of course, we are always happy to answer your questions also in German, also in the exercises. Yeah, the tutors speak English and German, so you can ask obviously in any language. The final exam, for the final exam, the text will be in English, but you can answer in English or in German. Okay? So it's no problem. You don't need to write English answers. If you prefer German answers, then that's also fine. Yeah?
Is there a difference for the exam between 5 and 7.5?
No, the exam is exactly the same. Okay. If there are no further questions. Then... we can start. And we will start with simple 2D graphics. So the goal of the lecture in the end, yeah, is to make 3D graphics. That means we have three-dimensional worlds as you know them from computer games or from movies. And we will learn how we can generate 2D images or movies from such 3D world descriptions. But before we can do that, we will make a very quick start using 2D graphics. So for the first 2 weeks, I think we will only look into 2D graphics and then quickly make the step from 2D to 3D. Yeah, but just the basic things I would like to introduce with 2D before we make the step to 3D. And so very generally, the goal of this lecture or computer graphics is about the generation of images with computers. Yeah, so we will learn different tools to generate images. Yeah, as I said, as you know them from computer games or from movies, or maybe from nice illustrations, yeah, nice graphs that visualize complicated things. And we will learn here in the lecture the basics of that. And of course, now the interesting question is, what is an image in that context? And if I ask you what is a computer image, many people of you probably will say, it's a file with an ending .jpeg, yeah, .jpg or .png, or maybe a movie .whatever, mp4 or so. Yeah, that's true, that's an image. More mathematical driven people maybe might say, yeah, an image is a mapping, yeah, of a 2D region to a color. So for every point in a 2D region, the image tells me the color of that point. Yeah, that's also true. And what we will use here now as notion of an image is that an image is simply a 2D table of color values. Yeah, that means our image is usually rectangular. This is what we will need, what we will use. Our image usually is rectangular. It consists of little picture elements, and a picture element is called a pixel. Yeah, that's where the name pixel comes from. It stands for picture element. And it's just a table. Yeah, it has a number of columns, a width and a height, yeah, a number of rows. And that's what we will call an image. Yeah? And every pixel in that image, now it depends on the type of the image, can have different values. The most simple type of image is if every pixel can be on or off, yeah, if it can be black or white. Yeah, on old computers, yeah, it was only possible to turn a pixel on or off. So one single bit was enough to describe the state of one pixel in an image. It can be a gray value if we have black and white images. Yeah, then it's not only black or white, but we can also have, yeah, not only 50, but in fact 256 shades of gray. Yeah, and 256 because we have 8 bits per pixel usually. Yeah, just because computers usually think in bytes or are organized as bytes. So we spend 1 byte per pixel, and then we can store 256 different gray values. Or, and that's the normal case, yeah, we have a color image, so we also have to describe color in the single pixels. And as you probably know, we describe colors by using 3 values, a red, a green, and a blue value. I will come back to that also in a minute, how that exactly works. And this allows us not only to give a brightness to pixels, but also a color. Yeah, and to describe that, we use 3 values, and usually we take 3 bytes or 3 times 8 bits. And that's the probably normal way an image is described, yeah? Using 3 byte per pixel. 3 is a weird number for computers, so often pixels contain 4 bytes, often images contain 4 bytes per pixel, and the 4th byte then can be used for transparency. That's also sometimes helpful, yeah, that you have an image where not everything is opaque, but can also be transparent, and then this 4th channel is used for transparency, and then we have 32 bits per pixel, which is usually one word in a computer, yeah, and that's a very, very convenient size that fits well with most architectures. And another extension is that sometimes we say that the 8 bits per channel, yeah, or 8 bits brightness are not enough. If you take outside world images, for instance, the dynamic range between dark and bright is much bigger than it can be described by 8 bits. So in that case, we use, for instance, floating point numbers to describe the brightness. Yeah, and then for each floating point number, we need 32 bits usually. Yeah, and then we have 3 by 32, and this is called what we call high dynamic range images. Yeah. Okay, so this is about the space in which we will work, but most of the time we will think of this here, that a single pixel has 3 bytes, a red, a green, and a blue value, and this describes the color of that pixel. And altogether, this table is an image. And to display the image, what we usually do is that we store these images in files. These are these files that you know. There are many different file formats available, like JPEG, TIFF, PNG, BMP, you name it. Many, many such file formats. And usually in these file formats, the images are stored compressed. That means there's an additional algorithm running on this image and compressing that image to a smaller image size. And now for images, compression is in particular interesting because if you take such a computer image and at one pixel, you just change the red value by one bit, just by one. Nobody will notice that. So you have some freedom in the in changing color values so that you can compress them better. And so image compression is a very, or at least was a very active field of research. How can we compress images to as small as possible size so that they just need less space on disk, that they can be faster transmitted, and so forth. So we have compressed file formats, which are usually lossy. That means information gets lost. They can change the images a little bit. Or we also have lossless compression formats like PNG, for instance. It doesn't compress as well as JPEG, but it's really lossless. Every after compression, every pixel has exactly the same value as it had before. Or we can, some file formats are even uncompressed. That's really the byte values are written next to each other to files, like BMP, for instance, is an uncompressed file format. And probably you know that these files quickly become very big, which is not really desirable. Or they can also be stored as part of movies. So in a movie, the images are not compressed separately, but usually an image is always compressed relative to the previous image. So if we only want to store or have to store the differences to the previous image, we need much less space because usually images in a movie have some similarity. And this then allows even more compression. So if you stream, for instance, a video, then usually this, it's the only practical way is to use a file format compresses this as a movie. And to show you a little bit differences, maybe, so here we have an image that has been taken by a normal DSLR. It has an image size of roughly 4,000 by 2,500. That's 10 megapixels, I think. So if we really would store the raw data, it would be 30 megabytes, which is already quite big. If we store it in the BMP format, that's an uncompressed file. Again, it's 30 megabytes, because it's not compressed. If we store it as PNG, which is compressed but lossless, the size is about little bit less than half, 13.8 megabytes. And JPEG is a compressed or a lossy file format. And in fact, if we have lossy file formats, we can usually trade quality versus compression. So we can select, for instance, good quality, which means it's less compressed than we have 6 megabytes, but we can also compress it, for instance, down to 200 kilobytes, which is low quality. And probably here on the projector, you cannot realize it well, but if you look at the slides, you will see severe artifacts. So for instance, obviously the colors here, the blue of the sky is not using the full range, but there are discrete steps of blue. So there are less steps which need less memory. And you can quickly see the price for this high compression. And if we store it in a full HD movie, for instance, and we do a streaming with high definition, usually something like 5 megabit per second is not uncommon. So if we say we have 25 frames per second with that rate, so every image only has 25 kilobytes, which is even less more than here. But This is just for completeness. Yeah, we won't look into this compression part at all. Yeah, it's just to explain we have what we are generating are these 2D tables. Yeah, this is what we are aiming for. And then how this is saved to a file and so forth. Yeah, this is not what we worry about. Yeah, there are libraries to take such a table and store it as PNG or whatever. We don't care about that. Yeah. We just want to generate these 2D tables. And in fact, normally we don't even store them off to disk, but we store them in what we call the frame buffer. And the frame buffer is just a part of your memory in a computer that keeps the image that is shown on your screen. So normally what you have is that every application is running on your screen, yeah? Each of these applications has an own frame buffer, and the application then can display different content by writing into that frame buffer, and then this frame buffer content is shown on your screen. And if you have multiple applications that have different windows that can overlap, yeah, then there is another entity responsible, which is called the window manager, to display that content in different windows. We also don't care about that. Yeah? We just say our application has something like a frame buffer. This frame buffer is just a piece of memory containing this table, and we write pixel values into this table, and then it's somehow magically displayed on the screen. Yeah? Okay. And so, yeah, for each window or for every program we run, we have one such frame buffer, and we are filling that frame buffer, and then we see the result on the screen. Yeah? And what goes on afterwards, whether we want to save it off to disk or something, we don't really care. And yeah, just to just to explain that maybe a little bit. Yeah, so here I have a little demo, so we will have that quite often. And this is another advantage, by the way, of using JavaScript, is that we can even do programming in the browser. Yeah, we can, in a window, in a browser, edit code and execute that code immediately and see the result. And here we have a very simple example. We will do more of that on Thursday, where we sort of directly fill that frame buffer. I mean, it's not the way that graphics is done usually. It's really only for explaining what's going on behind. So can you all read that code, or should I make it a little bit? Let me. Okay. Yeah, good. Should be okay. okay, so what we see here is now a simple, very simple program. This program is JavaScript, and for now, really, the main difference between JavaScript and Java for you is that variables don't have a type, or you don't have to declare a type. If you declare a variable, you just say var. So var fb means take a variable. Yeah, this has whatever type. It can be a float, an integer, or whatsoever, a string. FB now is a sort of pointer, or gives us back this frame buffer table, and now we can directly write to that frame buffer. We can directly set single values in that frame buffer. And what we want to do here, obviously, is we want to draw a little square. Yeah. And now we can do that by simply enumerating all the points in the square using a nested loop. So we say, okay, the y coordinate of that square goes from 100 to 300. The x coordinate goes from 100 to 300. Now we enumerate, yeah, all the pixels within the square. We compute the index in the table. This table is a 1D table only. Yeah. So it has, for every pixel, three values next to each other, red, green, and blue for the first pixel, then red, green, and blue for the next pixel. So we compute the position in this table and call this I, and then we fill the three color values, and you see we fill them red becomes zero, green becomes 255, blue becomes zero. So the result is that all these pixels become green. And if we want to make them red, we do it like this, and then we get a red one. And if we want to make it in yellow, we will see that green and red together gives yellow. Then we get this. And if we want to make it smaller, for instance, we loop less. Let's make it in red. Now we have a smaller rectangle, or we move it a little bit to the right and go from 200 to 400 in, not to the right, move it a bit downwards, and so forth. That's not how we will do graphics in the end, by directly writing into that frame buffer, but it's just to have sort of a mental model of what we want to do in the end, or what we want to achieve in the end. And if we are a little more creative, maybe you saw the exercise sheet, or you remember that, you have to do essentially the same to draw a circle and a ring around that circle. And you can think of many other interesting things. So maybe we want to draw a spiral like this here, or a sine curve. Now you can play around here and generate different images as you wish. Okay. Oops. Okay, good. And now I always said, when we want to set a single pixel, we have to set three values, red, green, and blue. And I think that's common knowledge today, that colors on a computer are represented by three values, a red, a green, and a blue value. But nevertheless, let me briefly explain where that comes from and how we use that in computer graphics. So in fact, this is not an introduction to color. This would be an entire lecture, or in fact, probably you can even generate a complete study program with what color is. But just the basics that we use here in computer graphics. And the reason that we use three colors in computer graphics is that the images that we generate in computer graphics are usually looked at by human observers. And there are many experiments in human perception that tell us that obviously the human color vision is three-dimensional. So the way that we perceive color can be described by three values. You all know these simple things that you do already in kindergarten or in school. For instance, if you have watercolor and you have red, blue, and yellow, you learn that you can mix most of the colors using these, just by mixing these three basic colors. And there are several other experiments that tell us that obviously the human vision is three-dimensional. And in fact, of course, it's a little bit more complicated. So what if you look closer or make more experiments, it has been realized that the retina, where at the back of the eye, where human vision happens, has two types of sensors. They have rods and cones. Rods mainly react to brightness, so they only deliver a black and white image. And they are very sensitive. They also have a very high resolution, so they are mainly in the center of the fovea, and this is the part with which you see also at night. So this is why night vision doesn't have color. You know this German, at least the saying, at night all cats are gray. And then there are additional sensors that obviously perceive color. And there are, as I said, different experiments that come to the end that we perceive colors in three dimensions. And now we can represent colors such as triples, as triple values. And usually we assign them the basic colors, red, green, and blue, and can show then, at least, I mean, every computer monitor works with that principle, and obviously we can display at least a large fraction of visible colors on a computer monitor, so obviously that's working. And now to describe color, we can define very different color models. And there are color models that come from human perception, where really the human perception is measured in experiments where different charts are shown with slightly different colors, and people have to say whether they can differentiate the color or not. Yeah, and from that, these three-dimensional sort of basic base colors of human perception can really be measured. These are experiments that have already been done, I think, in the 30s, and the corresponding color space is called XYZ. And there, in the experiments, it was shown that the color perception of humans is rather uniform, so there are not very big differences between the different observers. And they really defined sort of the spectrum of the three different color channels of human vision. Now, this one is rather complicated. It's tabulated. You can download these curves that come from the experiments. But in computer graphics, usually, we don't take such perception-driven color models, but we use technology-driven models. And what does that mean? Probably you also know that on a computer screen, color is represented by mixing red, green, and blue. Yeah, it's a little bit like the watercolor example, but there's also a fundamental difference. I will come back to that in a minute. So every pixel on a computer screen, in fact, if you take a magnifying glass, so let's say this is one pixel, and if you have an LCD screen and you take a magnifying glass, you will realize that this pixel has three subpixels. And fantastically, I just have the right colors here. There's a red one, a green one, and a blue one. And they are so small that you don't see that they have different colors. Yeah, but as I said, with a magnifying glass, you can realize that. And now we can represent most of the visible colors, yeah, by turning these subpixels on with different relative brightness. Yeah? So if we make the red one, if we give it maximal color, yeah, let's say 1 and the other one 0, then we get red. If we turn these two, for instance, on, red and green, we get yellow, maybe surprisingly, yeah, and so forth. And if we turn all of them on, we get white. Yeah, white is just a mix where all colors are on at the same time. We perceive it as an own color, but you know from these rainbow experiments that white light consists of the entire spectrum of visible colors, yeah. And this is the same here. Our spectrum is very, very sparse. Yeah, we only have three colors. But if we turn all of them on, we get white. And obviously, if we turn all of them off, we get black. Okay? And this is how this works technically. Yeah, such a screen. And of course, now we also define colors in that way. Yes, we say, okay, for that pixel, red needs that brightness, green needs that brightness, and blue needs that brightness. These are exactly the values that I've just in the example before written to the frame buffer. And these are just the values that are then used to show the color of that particular pixel. And this red, green, blue, now of course is not randomly chosen, but this is rather closely related to these curves X, Y, Z that have been measured here by perceptual experiments. It's not the same, yeah, but it's from a technical point of view, it's how that works, so it's related, but it's not really, it doesn't really come from measurements here. And in fact, it's even worse. From screen to screen, this red, green, and blue are different. So the color 100 on your mobile phone will look different than it will look on a screen or on a TV or it will on an Apple, it will look different from a Samsung and whatever. From a Samsung 10, it will look different than on a Samsung 9. Yeah, so what red, green, and blue exactly means is not clearly defined. And there is a standardized RGB space, which is called sRGB, and here really the spectra of red, green, and blue are normalized or standardized, so that you can be sure that 100 is a particular red. Yeah, but I won't really detail on that. Okay, so these are the technology-driven color ways to describe color. These we will look into. But as I said, there are also more perception-driven. We will look into two very simple examples for perception-driven colors. And some of them are even standardized. So X, Y, Z, as I said, you can really download these tables, these curves that have been measured. LAB or sRGB, for instance, yeah, these are standardized color spaces. Okay, so let's look at the most important ones for our purpose. And as I said, it's technology driven, it's the RGB color model, yeah, because it directly relates to how a computer screen normally works. And so every color is described by a red, a green, and a blue value because it's three-dimensional, and for now all values are between 0 and 1. We can define a cube, yeah, the color cube, and every point within that cube is a particular color. And obviously the origin, 0, 0, 0, is black. Here the opposite vertex or corner is white. This is 1, 1, 1. Here along the axis we have red, green, and blue. Yeah? And there are also mixed colors, like, as I already said, green and red together give yellow. Green and blue give cyan, and blue and red give magenta. Yeah? And yeah, all these points on the diagonal are grayscale values and so forth. And this, how this mixing of the color works can also be seen here. Yeah, so we have the basic colors, red, blue, and green. If we mix red and green, we get yellow. This is magenta. This is cyan. And if we mix all three, we get white. And this is what we call additive mixing, because what happens here, yeah, is that if we turn on one of these pixels and make it brighter, the entire pixel becomes brighter. Yeah? The colors are mixed additively. In your eye, the light coming from these three subpixels is mixed. Yeah? It's so small that you don't see the boundaries in between, yeah? And you perceive that as one single pixel that is at the same time emitting red and green light, for instance, and blue light. And now the watercolor example that I told you before is similar in spirit, yeah? But in fact, it's exactly the opposite, yeah? Because what do you do if you take watercolors? You start with a white paper, and then if you put ink on it, yeah, red ink, for instance, reflects everything but red, yeah? So red ink absorbs blue and green, for instance, yeah? It only reflects light with a certain frequency. Only red light is reflected if you place red ink on a white sheet of paper. So whenever you add ink, yeah, you remove light. And this is what we call subtractive color mixing. And in fact, now this looks a little bit different. So in these subtractive mixing, as it, by the way, also printers do, yeah, printers that print ink work exactly the same way. You always start with white, and then you add ink, yeah, so that less color is reflected, yeah, and you color the white paper by this. And now, if we would use, for instance, red, green, and blue ink, that would not be very helpful, yeah, because if we add red ink, then everything is reflected but red. And if we now add blue ink, the result must be black, right? Because the blue is already completely absorbed by the red ink, yeah? And then with the blue ink, you immediately get black. So what we do instead, in that case, is that we take these mixed colors from here, Yeah, yellow, for instance, reflects red and green. So we take yellow as one basic color, then we take magenta and cyan. We take these as basic colors, yeah? Because cyan reflects everything except red, yellow reflects everything except blue, and magenta reflects everything except green. Yeah, this is what we call opposite colors also. And in this model now, we take ink, that is yellow, cyan, and magenta. Yeah, if you have a printer and you have to buy ink, yeah, you will realize this. Yeah, CMY, that's exactly these basic colors. And now we can mix them. If we mix yellow and magenta, we get red. If we mix yellow and cyan, we get green. Magenta and cyan gives you blue. And if we mix all of the three, we get black. Yeah, because here now in black, really everything is removed and black remains. And now we can also describe this by a cube. And this cube, in fact, is very similar to the one before. And we can even the computation is very simple, because cyan now here in this color model is just 1 minus red in the other color model, and magenta is 1 minus green, and yellow is 1 minus blue. Yeah, so it's very simple to convert these colors, and the color cube now looks not very much different. It's in the origin, now we have white. 000 means no ink. Yeah, so white paper remains. Black means 111. Yeah, so all color here, this is 111. And here now we have what was previously the base colors, red, green, and blue. And here along the axis we have cyan, yellow, and magenta. Okay, yeah, so this is how a printer works. And it's rather simple to convert that, and we don't have to worry about that. But I think it's worth mentioning the difference between that subtractive color model and here previously the additive. Yeah, so what we do on a computer and how we store our images is always such an additive mode. Yeah, additive color mixing. Okay, and then there's a special way, probably you also know that in your color printers, usually you do not only have color ink, but you also have black ink. And the reason for that is very simple, because normally black is a color that is very often printed. Whenever you print text or so, you normally print it in black. And now in this model, that would mean that you print yellow, cyan, and magenta. Yeah, so you use all that expensive ink to generate black. Yeah, you have to print all these colors on top of each other. And to avoid that, or to make that cheaper, a fourth channel is added. Sorry. A fourth channel is added, and this is just black. Yeah, and black is just the minimum of C, M, and Y. And then we can subtract that from C, M, and Y, and we have a four-dimensional color space now, which just uses a little bit less ink. Okay. Good. Yeah, and here we have now again an image of that cube. And the next thing we want to look into is now a more perception-based way to describe color. Because if you now in a user interface, for instance, you want a user to define a color, yeah, then you will run into problems. Because for a human person, it's very, very difficult to find the position for RGB sliders so that you end up in a particular color. Yeah, you want to exactly meet the green of this board, or exactly this red here of the chalk. Yeah, that's very difficult. But there are much better models that are more intuitive for human observers. And the typical way to do that is the following. So let's say we take this RGB cube. Yeah, RGB, we are not in CMY, we are in RGB. And now we look at this RGB cube along the diagonal here on this point, on this white point. So this is this view on this cube. Yeah, so here you see white, that this one, cyan is here, blue is here, yeah, magenta is here, red, yellow, blue, and obviously now here we have something very colorful. Yeah, And it almost looks a little bit like a rainbow. It's not a bow, but a circle. But nevertheless, yeah, sort of shows a lot. It's very colorful here around the boundary. And now we use this notion to define a new color model. Yeah, and this works like this. Yeah, we take that color cube, and now we say, okay, here, if we go around the silhouette, we get the rainbow colors, yeah? Red, magenta, blue, cyan, green, yellow, back to red. I mean, on a real rainbow, obviously, it's not cyclic, yeah? But here we have a cycle, so it doesn't really work like a rainbow, but nevertheless, we get the full spectrum of all possible colors. And if we go inwards, these colors don't really change, they just shift towards white. And this is what we call saturation. So if we take as example red, for instance, if we move towards white, here we would have a color which is probably pink. Yeah, pink is just an unsaturated red. And the same for green, yeah, so you have a light green here, and so forth, yeah? So, a second axis, so the first axis, now to define a color, yeah, we say, where along the silhouette is our sort of main color, or the hue of this color, in German Farbton, yeah? So, where on the silhouette is the hue of the color? From there on, we determine how saturated is the color. This is saturation, that's the second component, and obviously, we need a third one, because now we are only here on the side faces of the color cube, which are the most colorful. And if from there on we go towards the origin, we just make the color darker. Yeah? So that's the third component. That's just from there on, which is on the surface of the cube, we go towards black. And this is the final value, which we call value. Yeah? The brightness of that. And now this we can also describe by a cone. So often it's not shown like this hexagon, yeah, but this hexagon is blown to a cone. And on this cone now we have the three axis hue, then chroma, which is another word for saturation, and the value, that's the brightness, yeah? And then all the colors, it makes sense to merge these here at the tip of the cone, because yeah, a black red is exactly the same like a black blue, yeah, or a zero brightness black blue is just black, yeah. So these colors converge here. So in the end, we get this cone, and we can address every position in this cone using U, chroma, and value. And each of these points in the cone is a color, yeah. And this is much more intuitive for people now to select a color using this scheme, or this is exactly the same, but not as a cone, but as a cylinder. But you see here at the bottom, all the colors are the same. Yeah, so probably this visualization makes more sense. And of course, there are formulas to convert now from RGB to HSV. HSV is this model here. Yeah, hue, saturation, value. And also vice versa here, but I mean, okay, that's not of very much interest. Interesting is it probably because you probably know that model. If anywhere in a program you have to select a color, usually you do that with a dialog that looks like this. Oh, it's probably very small, I think. I cannot increase its size, but for now that's probably enough. And what you see here now is that these are exactly these parameters. Probably you cannot read it, but that one says Farbton, this is U, saturation, and Helligkeit, value. Yeah, so these are the three values you can select. You can also select red, green, and blue directly. But this would be more complicated. And here we see also a sort of visualization of all these colors, so we can directly click in here. I hope we could do, yeah. So you here see, yeah, hue, saturation, and value for these. And here we have a slider. And with that, we can change. And that now that's a little bit a different model. It's not HSV, but it's called HSL. So saturation and value are more mixed. Yeah, but nevertheless, I mean, the principle is always the same. We can here sort of select the color tone, and here we can select the saturation or the value of that. Yeah, and so it's again three-dimensional. Okay, here again the explanation how that essentially works like. Okay, yeah, and that's yeah how these color pickers usually work. But yeah, these are the values that are typically selected, and then they are converted to red, green, and blue, and these are the values that are then used in software. Yeah, this is what we take then in the end. And in fact, color is, yeah, as I said, yeah, so I really, these are really only the very, 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 very basics, yeah. Color is extremely difficult, yeah, because a human observer is involved. And calibrating colors, yeah, so that you can rely on that a color really on a printer looks like it looks on your screen and so on is, yeah, I would say even unsolved problem still. Yeah, it's very tricky. And you see there are very many different notions of color. I mean, yeah, this is an XKCD, so it's more funny, but it's also true. Yeah, there are many different ways to describe color, a rainbow, and each color is a wavelength, a mix of infinite wavelengths filtered through three eye pigments. Yeah, that's what we heard. Something about the opponent color model. Yeah, that's also what I heard. These opponent colors, blue and yellow. There are also experiments that tell us that color perception mainly works via opposite colors, and so forth. Yeah, and in the end, it's hopefully somebody else's problem. And that's a very good description of color. Yeah, we won't worry about that too much for us. Now, color is red, green, and blue. Yeah, and we know how to do the most important conversions so that if we want to interact with humans, we take something like HSV, which is more intuitive. And if we want to interact with printers, we take CMY so that they can directly be printed. Okay, so surprisingly, I'm too fast today, but I hope that's okay for you. So after this very brief and coarse introduction about what is an image, yeah, what is stored in an image, what is what we want to generate. We will now in the next lecture on Thursday, we will look into first images, how now we can rasterize simple primitives, yeah, like the circle from the exercises. So we will see more examples how we can do that. And we will learn, of course, as I said, we won't do these rasterization you normally by hand, but there are many, many libraries available for us that do that. And we will look into libraries and APIs that do this image drawing stuff for us, and we'll learn the most important concepts about that. We will then learn about transforming these primitives. So primitives here means line segments, triangles, circles, stuff like that. We will learn how to transform them, yeah, how to geometrically describe all that stuff. And then we will go to 3D. This will be in about 2 weeks or so. We will then learn how to describe these primitives in 3D, three-dimensional worlds, and how to project then these 3D worlds into 2D images. Yeah, this will involve how a camera works, how can we simulate that geometrically, how can we describe that using simple linear algebra, and so forth. And then we will more and more come to the problem. We have a three-dimensional world, described with objects that have some surface properties. We have light sources that illuminate these objects. How can we compute the colors for these objects? Yeah, so that we compute the pixel values from a simple physical simulation. How do we compute occlusion in three-dimensional an object? Yeah, objects can be behind each other, so we need to find out which one is in front to render that properly. We will see how we model large scenes with many objects, yeah, not a single triangle or a line or an arrow, but maybe a forest with 1,000 trees and branches and leaves and mushrooms on the ground and so forth. Yeah, and this will always be a topic. How can we do this, or how can we render all this using GPUs? These are these very powerful additional processors that you have in your computer that are mainly, or yeah, even only there for doing graphics. Sometimes they can be used for other things, or more and more for other things, but mostly they are there just to do that graphics problem more efficiently and much faster, so that it's fast enough that you can play, for instance, a computer game. And in the very end, we will also look in another method, which is called ray tracing, which allows us now to add nice additional effects like shadows, reflections, and so on to our scenes. This we will do probably in the last 2 weeks. In between, we will also look a little bit into virtual reality. I forgot that here on the slide. But we will also see how these virtual reality glasses work and what's the technology behind that. And then in the end do ray tracing. And that's everything for today. Next lecture, simple rasterization and graphics APIs. And next lecture will be Thursday 10:15, right? Exactly here again. Thank you.